I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. As the Philippines and the world community struggle to help people stranded without food, water, or shelter after the devastating Typhoon Haiyan, diplomats from over 190 countries are meeting in Warsaw for the annual UN Summit on Climate Change. What's the coverage been like, and are journalists connecting the dots? Carbon emissions are a big deal in China, which has 16 of the 20 most polluted cities in the world. According to The Week, there are 30 to 50,000 mass incidents of environmental protest every year. And big news this morning, China is easing its one-child policies and say that they're going to abolish re-education camps. We're going to talk about all of that and the recent and increasing crackdown on foreign media in that country. One of our guests, who's been reporting from China for nearly two decades, was recently denied a journalist visa, ironically on the day of the journalist last Friday, November 8th. He'll tell us why. And you can join our conversation and tell us where you saw great reporting or tell us about a story you think deserves more coverage. It's our Friday Media Roundtable, and I'm joined by Jason Mark, who's editor of the quarterly environmental magazine Earth Island Journal. Hi, Mark.
Hi there.
Hi, Jason. Sorry. That's the danger of having
two first names.
And Reuters' Paul Mooney, who was recently denied the visa to report in China, is joining us. Hi, Paul.
Hi,
we're sorry you're not in China, but we're glad to have you here.
Thank you.
So as you both know, we always like to start the week with positive news and give a shout out to a journalist or an outlet that did a great job reporting. Do you want to start us off, Jason?
Yeah, I thought a story that I saw this week that I thought was really excellent was an in-depth feature profile of Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell by Bruce Barcott in Outside Magazine. And, you know, they'd kept Secretary Jewell pretty well under wraps for the first 6 months of her tenure, and this past week was kind of her coming out, or I guess the past couple weeks. And obviously they decided to give Bruce Barcott kind of the inside exclusive on a profile of her, but he did a really good job, and he broke down what her leadership is going to mean for her management of essentially one-fifth of U.S. territory. You know, the Department of the Interior oversees a huge portfolio, including, yeah, one out of every 5 acres of the United States.
And give us just a little thumbnail sketch. We'll read it all later. It'll all be at yourcallradio.org. But what is this going to mean?
I mean, the thumbnail sketch is kind of who is Sally Jewell and where do her passions lie. She's the former CEO of outdoor outfitter REI, and so she's clearly got a real commitment to the outdoors. She's got a clear, real passion to getting especially youth and communities of color into our national parks. At the same time, she started her career as an oil and gas engineer. Hmm. And she's come out pretty strongly in favor of fracking on public lands. Her statements about fracking, oil and gas extraction, and mining on public lands have been sort of mixed. And so the question is sort of, which Sally Jewell are we going to get, the CEO of REI or the former oil and gas engineer?
Or a mixture of both.
Or probably a mixture of both.
And you say that's in Outside Magazine?
Outside Magazine. And I'm sure it's outsidemagazine.com.
And we'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Paul Mooney. What is your pick of the week?
Well, it's really not a pick of the week. It's based on it's a book that was written over 20 years ago by Alex Kotlowitz, and it's called There Are No Children Here. It's become a classic, but I'd never heard about it before. But it made a deep impression on me because he went into the Henry Horner Projects in Chicago, a crime-ridden area, and spent 2 years following a family around focused on two children. And as I've tried to do reporting like this, I know how difficult it is, and I just thought it was an amazing piece of journalism that he would devote 2 years of his life to doing this. And it had to be quite dangerous too, because there were gangs in the area. It was quite dangerous, and you know, for a kind of for someone to go into an area like this, and it took a lot of courage, I think.
And that's Alex Kotlowitz. There Are No Children Here, and he's actually continued to do that kind of reporting.
Right.
We had him on the show pretty recently. All right, so let's turn then from Alex Kotlowitz to the ongoing climate talks in Warsaw. They're happening right now through November 22nd,
I think. End of next week, yeah.
End of next week. And we've got delegates from almost 200 countries that are trying to reach an agreement by 2015 on a new protocol to succeed the Kyoto protocols. So China and India, which don't have caps under Kyoto, are pushing for developed countries to pay the promised money that they had said that to countries affected by climate change. What, $30 billion, I think, China asked for?
Well, what they're shooting for, the main thing that Hillary Clinton promised a couple years ago at one of the UN climate talks, and it's still in place, is that by 2020, wealthy countries will be donating up to $100 billion a year into a fund to help poor nations both mitigate their greenhouse gas emissions and have money for climate adaptation, dealing with the inevitable droughts, floods, extreme weather that's going to come with that. And this is one of the main issues, is how is that money, is that money actually going to even, you know, there's all these pledges, but no one's actually got any money into the pipeline. And I think what's really, this is the elephant in the room, is the inherent inequality of climate change, is that, you know, we've got industrialized powers, the U.S., Japan, Western Europe, that have become wealthy and comfortable and affluent based on burning all of these fossil fuels. And yet the impacts of climate change, as we've seen in the Philippines this week, are likely to hit hardest on poor nations, on nations that are in the sort of tropical belt, you know, on low-lying nations, nations that have got a lot of their population concentrated around, you know, around coastlines. And so it's less a technical issue in terms of how do you reduce greenhouse gas emissions, as it's this really huge geopolitical tension about fairness
and distribution of wealth. And resources, right?
And distribution of responsibility, of who's going to pay for the sort of nomenclature that's come out of the talks is loss and damage. Who's going to pay for the loss and damage that's going to be inevitable in climate change? And The Guardian, which always seems to get leaked documents, The Guardian got some leaked documents this week, and that was the U.S.'s internal negotiating position. And they were concerned, quote, that the talks are going to focus increasingly on blame and liability, and that poor nations will, quote, be seeking redress for climate damages from sea level rise, droughts, powerful storms, and other impacts.
Well, and so China is a big player, China and India, and China's chief climate negotiator, Su Wei, said that in Warsaw that developed nations should make good on the pledges that they made in 2010 and immediately pay the promised $30 billion. What are some of the geopolitical questions, dynamics of the UN summit? I'm going to ask both of you, but you start, Jason.
I mean, the tricky thing is you've now got this block of countries which is called BASIC, which is, you know, that's Brazil, South Africa, India, and China. So these emerging, or in the case of, you know, India and China, beyond emerging industrial powers. And they are now serving as this real sort of counterweight to the United States and I guess also a little bit towards the EU. I mean, the EU's got sort of this enlightened self-interest negotiating policy. The U.S., unfortunately, is pretty retrograde. And it's those countries that really have the most ability just because they're large economies and they're increasingly large emitters. I mean, China's now the largest emitter. Brazil is...
And China has a big pollution problem.
A huge pollution problem, yeah. Yes, they are going deeply, and Paul can talk more about this, I'm sure, than I can. I mean, yes, their renewables sector is growing far faster than here in the U.S., but their coal sector continues to grow as well. And they are now the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions. But so much of this gets into the historical responsibilities. The weather that we are seeing now, the increased temperatures that we are seeing now, those are from emissions that are already baked into the system. Those are from emissions 20 years ago. The emissions that we're having today, we will see the consequences of those in mid-century. And so,
and people are predicting that we're going to see more of these superstorms around the globe, but especially in vulnerable places like the Philippines.
Correct. And so I think, you know, and especially for a show on the media, I'd really recommend for people who want to follow this closely, some of the best English language reporting you can get the other side of the viewpoint is the Indian press, the Times of India or the Hindu, which it's like going through the looking glass, you know, and you really get to see how people in the poorer nations view these summits. And it's just a kind of 180 degrees from what you see in the U.S. press.
Well, I'd be curious to see what you see in the Chinese press around environmental issues and like the climate summit, Paul.
Right. Well, there's a Chinese reporters don't have you know, they're restricted in what they can report about issues like this. The government's very sensitive about reporting on the environment and human rights and other issues. And so I was looking this morning at some of the Chinese reports, and they were fairly bland. They weren't going into the politics of this. And, you know, China's when I first arrived in China, maybe 94, one of the first stories I did was on pollution in Beijing. And the situation's gotten considerably worse, you know. And so I, you know, the Chinese government has long kind of seen pressure on them to deal with this as a kind of a Western tactic to slow down China's development. Mm-hmm. So they're reluctant. They don't want to sacrifice, the economy for the environment. And so they haven't really taken the steps they need to take.
And yet it's not something like, say, national security or a crackdown on internet access that you can just sweep under the rug. I mean, you can see the pollution
exactly.
in Beijing and in other cities
right.
where sometimes they're saying it's reaching like 900 times the safe level.
Right.
So what kinds of conversations are happening in China about
right.
this?
Well, there's more of a conversation on this now. You have people on the social media. They're quite active. You have NGOs. And there are Chinese journalists now that are covering the environment. But there's still a limit to what they can do. And there was a former forestry official who campaigned on an environmental issue, and he was arrested.
Mm.
And this is common for whistleblowers to be detained or harassed because of it really kind of stops people from taking an active role. But we are seeing in the urban areas, in the cities, you know, people now, they have a bit more of a kind of have incomes and they're living better. And now they're starting to look at the environment. And we hear about people keeping their kids home from school on certain days because the pollution is so high.
And when I read in, I think it was The Week, that there are 30 to 50,000 environmental protests in China, or what they called mass incidents a year. Does that sound right to you? It just seemed like
yeah.
something I hadn't heard about at all.
China's a big country, you know, and we did have one area where a factory was going to open up in a place called Shifang, and local residents protested it. The government tried to kind of ram it through. And what was interesting is it was middle school students who were computer savvy and went online and started to send out messages. They were posting photos. The police came in and cracked down, and it became viral in China. And it was started by middle school students who were threatened by the school not to get involved.
And I think I read in something that was attributed to you, but I'm not sure, that some middle school student was arrested.
Right. Yeah. So that was, you know, the government's been cracking down recently on kind of freedom of expression and the internet, and they just passed a new law against spreading rumors. And a middle school student, high school student, 16 years old, was detained for a week. There had been a murder, and he accused the police of not investigating what had happened, not taking steps. And so they're even going after teenagers.
That's Paul Mooney. He's an award-winning freelance journalist who's reported on China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong since 1985. He is actually a reporter with Reuters, and he was denied a visa to report from China. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Jason Mark is the editor of the quarterly environmental magazine Earth Island Journal. He's also co-author of Building the Green Economy, Success Stories from the Grassroots. And you're listening to Your Call. It's our weekly Friday media roundtable. I'm Holly Kernan. I'll give you the number to join our conversation in just a moment, but let's talk a tiny bit more about the Philippines and this UN summit on climate change. The Philippine head of the Philippine delegation to the UN, Yeb Sano, said he was going to go on a hunger strike, and he said, that this is clearly, that the typhoon is clearly linked to climate change. What my country is going through as a result of this extreme climate event is madness. The climate crisis is madness. We can stop this madness right here in Warsaw. What kind of an effect is his speech, which he was in tears, it brought other people to tears? What kind of effect is this having?
I mean, it was really powerful, and I would really encourage people to look for it, you know, on YouTube or whatever. When I checked last night,
we'll put a link to it.
Yeah,
at
it had
Your
something
Call
like 600,000 views, and you know, Sano really changed the script. These meetings are so sort of choreographed and organized, and everybody's got their positions when they come in. And he came in and he really did flip the script. He talks in his video for something like 5 minutes. You can hear the little bell chiming, telling me his time is over, but he's not getting cut off. He gets very emotional. He talks about his brother having to gather bodies there after the typhoon. And yes, he brought other people in the hall, other delegates, to tears. And it was an incredible, powerful demonstration of the real human consequences of climate change. And again, as we were saying earlier, the unequal and unjust impacts of climate change impacting a poorer nation like the Philippines that's less prepared to deal with an extreme storm like this. So what he did was incredibly eloquent and brave and courageous, and it sparked it sparks some now solidarity actions from other folks. There's a lot, mostly sort of, you know, from the environmental NGO community, people in Warsaw now doing solidarity fasts as well. And so I think that the Philippine story and Yeb Sanyo's courage is going to be sort of the current of news that's going to continue through the talks.
And one of the questions in U.S. media has been, can you really link this typhoon specifically to climate change? What have you been seeing all of those debates happening?
I mean, that's the constant debate that happens with every extreme weather event these days. I mean, we know at this point that the weather is a human artifact. I mean, you could say this is the 2013 will turn out to be one of the 10 warmest years since 1850 here in California. We're having our driest year ever since record keeping began in 1849.
We no longer know what rain is.
Yeah. And so you could say that any, portion of the weather is in some ways connected to our fossil fuel burning over the last century and a half. It always gets tricky, attributing a single storm or a single event. And I think the thing to communicate to folks is we've loaded the dice. At this point, yes, the weather is an unstable and unpredictable system, and it's a crapshoot. But at this point, we have loaded the dice through all of, again, the greenhouse gas emissions, the CO2 and the methane that we've spewed in the atmosphere. And so it's important to make those connections.
And I want to invite our listeners to join this conversation about the week's news. We're focusing on international coverage, particularly about global climate change, the hurricane in, the typhoon in the Philippines, also the crackdown on media in China, and the big news out of that country today that they're going to ease the one-child policy, and also they say they're going to abolish the re-education camps. The number to join our media roundtable conversation is 866-798-8255. Again, it's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we want to know where you've seen the best reporting this week on climate change or on the typhoon in the Philippines. You can give a shout-out to somebody during this roundtable. Also, what strikes you about the coverage of the devastating typhoon in the Philippines? What do you think is the role of media during such tragedies? And how much should media bring science and context during this kind of human tragedy? The number again is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And I want to ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Jason, what role do you think that the U.S. media is playing in creating a national conversation about global warming, this thing that can feel very abstract and huge and what do I do? It's so overwhelming.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. media's done a pretty horrible job on communicating climate change, I think, to the American people. I asked the folks over at Daily Climate, which is a great sort of a daily digest of climate change news. They keep a tracker of the, climate change news throughout the year. The last 4 years have seen a huge dip in climate change stories from something like... The last four. The
really?
Peak was in 2009 with something like 32,000 stories that year, and it went down to as low as 18,000 last year. So that's a drop of a third in
even
the
with
coverage.
All these, even with Hurricane Sandy and...
It's dipped back up this year, or it's come back up luckily, and it's on track for about 20,000 stories this year. But in general, the U.S. media has done a really poor job, and that's largely because I think of this, false parity between people who deny the science and folks who understand that we humans are changing the world's weather. I mean, 98% of atmospheric scientists agree that human activity is causing climate change, is causing global warming. But the U.S. media continues to do this false parity and this sort of false balance. And every time they do a story, they'll quote the one scientist and quote the other scientist and fail. I think failing readers, viewers, and listeners by putting that in context and really communicating that 98% of scientists agree.
That's interesting because I actually would disagree with that characterization. Just as a media watcher, I feel like that the tide has turned on that, that there isn't this, you know, tobacco might be bad for you, tobacco is bad for you kind of debate around global warming anymore. It seems like there's pretty broad reporting that there's a scientific consensus about this.
I mean, maybe I'm more sensitive to it because I see it every day, but I mean, we had a big snafu, to put it mildly, a real, I think, failure of journalism this year from the PBS NewsHour, which actually ended up getting the PBS Ombudsman to come in, a report by Spencer Michaels, based here in San Francisco, that really had a lot of false equivalency and led to such sort of an outcry that the PBS Ombudsman had to come in and do an investigation. And that's a blue chip media like the NewsHour. So I do think that there's still some problems with it.
And Paul, what is your sense of how well the U.S. media is doing, especially with your vantage point of having been inside of, you know, China and seeing how that media is able to cover it?
Well, it's, you know, for me, it's a bit of a problem because I've lived overseas for the past 28 years and I'm not as knowledgeable about what's going on in the U.S. But my sense is that the media has failed and that there's still a lot of people who don't believe that there's global warming, you know, and there's something wrong. People haven't been educated, you know, about this. So.
Although I would like to say there was a really interesting story that came out this week by Suzanne Goldberg at The Guardian, and based on a report from Stanford University researchers, a researcher at Stanford did some surveying and polling in red states, right, and found that even in places that would probably be considered very deep red, 87% of Oklahomans and 84% of Texans accept that climate change is occurring, and 76% of people in both those states believe the government should step in to limit greenhouse gas emissions. So I think, you know, there's...
Have you analyzed the difference in coverage in, say, Europe?
I do think the tide is turning.
But do you think that the coverage is different in, say, European countries?
For sure. I mean, climate denialism is almost entirely an Anglophone phenomenon. It's the U.S., Canada, the U.K., and Australia where you see this continued kind of debate about the science. Much of the rest of the world, that debate is long since over.
Is that debate over in China, Paul?
It never started in China. You know, like I said, there's, you know, the journalists are reporting more about environmental issues, but they're still restricted in what they report. And when I've reported on environmental issues, I had to worry about getting detained by police or local government officials. And, you know, when I interviewed people, I had to go to a tea house and take a private room to talk to villagers who's, you know, in a village where 1,000 people were found to have cadmium poisoning in their blood. And there's a big fear about talking about this. No one in the village would talk to me. I could only find two people to talk. So there's a fear in China about discussing sensitive issues like this.
And so how do you get around that fear as a journalist trying to report on these issues?
Well, I found that where people have a stake or their lives are affected, then they're willing to talk. And, you know, when I was in Hunan province, there were 400 cancer villages in China, you know, where the population, the majority of the population have come down with cancer related to pollution. I was in one village where a six-year-old girl died.
Related to pollution?
Cadmium
from
poisoning, yes. Uh-huh. A factory came in, paid off local environmental officials to get approvals for pollution control equipment they didn't have, and then proceeded to pour wastewater, heavy metals into the land, into the water. And the girl died, and her father took her to every hospital he could find, and they couldn't find out what was wrong, and then she died, and they gave her 6,000 renminbi, which is less than $1,000.
And when you do that kind of reporting, what kind of outcry is there? What kind of...
Oh, there's almost nothing. There's almost no response.
What kind of response is there from the Chinese government?
Well, they're not happy with the kind of reporting.
How do they convey that unhappiness?
Well, you know, in some cases they'll call reporters in and slap them on the wrist. In some cases they deny that there's a problem, or they'll say that it's a Western media bias that we're too negative about.
I've seen
China.
That a lot. Yeah.
Right. So it discourages any kind of discussion, you know, of this type of thing.
And you're listening to our Friday Media Roundtable. On Your Call, you just heard from Paul Mooney. He's an award-winning freelance journalist with Reuters. He's reported on China for almost 20 years, Taiwan, Hong Kong since 1985. And he's the author of 4 travel books on Taiwan and China. He's going to tell us about getting denied for the first time as a reporter in China when we come back after the break. Jason Mark is the editor of the quarterly environmental magazine Earth Island Journal. And we're talking about the week's news here on Your Call. You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number. And we'll be right back with Your Call after this short break.
Stories that you hear recommended on today's Friday Media Roundtable will be posted at yourcallradio.org. We invite you to highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling in 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or you can send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. It's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we're speaking with Paul Mooney, who is an award-winning journalist with Reuters. He reports on China from China. Jason Mark is the editor of the quarterly environmental magazine Earth Island Journal. And right before the break, we were talking, Paul, about the fact that there's this crackdown on foreign media in China. And just last Friday, after waiting, I think, 8 months, you were denied your journalist visa, ironically, on the day of the journalist in China. What happened?
Well, I think, you know, it's I was in China for 18 years as an accredited journalist, never had a problem getting a visa before. But in the last few years, they've stepped up pressure on the foreign media. And, you know, there are a growing number of problems now in China that the Communist Party's failed to deal with. There's, you know, there are environmental issues. There's, you know, migrant workers who factory workers, urban residents who've lost their houses. There's problems in Tibet, Mongolia, and Xinjiang, the Muslim area. And the party's not dealing with these issues, and they're getting worse. And so what they're seeking to do, and at the same time, social media has been quite active. Chinese citizens are going online and writing about these things. And so the Communist Party, I think it feels it has its back against the wall. And since they don't have policies to deal with these issues, their policy is further repression, and that includes restricting the media.
And why foreign media specifically now?
I think it's because they care about their image internationally. They're worried about how other countries see them. They want to be respected as a real power. And also I think a lot of our stories filter back into China. You know, there's, you know, a lot of the major news websites are blocked in China, so the average Chinese person doesn't have access. Some people use software to go over the firewall, but, you know, these things leak back, and there are prominent bloggers and people that are on Chinese versions of Twitter, and then it gets reported, and it gets spread, and the government doesn't want its people knowing.
Now, you're talking about this very obvious crackdown on foreign journalists, denying you your visa or censorship or that sort of thing. The New York Times reported on Friday that Bloomberg News spiked an investigative report into one of the founders of a real estate empire in China. We don't know. This is unconfirmed. Bloomberg, I think, is denying this.
They've denied it, yes.
But the idea of sort of self-censorship because people want to be have access in China. Right. How real is that? How widespread?
Well, you know, the New York Times has two correspondents that have been waiting 15 months and 20 months respectively to get visas. And Bloomberg has about a half dozen people. They haven't been able to replace reporters. Reporters can't leave who are supposed to leave because they can't get replacements in. And so it's been alleged that Bloomberg sat on a very important. So these are Bloomberg reporters who went to the New York Times and told them this. So Bloomberg's business has been affected within China, you know, because they sell their services in China. And so, you know, I think the Chinese government sees that this kind of news. And they realize, okay, this is working. And so they've recently blocked. New York Times has started some Chinese websites in China. One was about lifestyle. They've been blocked.
And the New York Times can't get their journalists' visas now either, right?
Right.
After that big expose that they did on the...
Right. They'll roll over visas of people already there. But, the new bureau chief and another correspondent have been sitting in Hong Kong for more than a year.
And we've got a lot of callers on the line, so I want to try and get to as many of them as possible. Let's go to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Welcome to your call.
Hi, yes. Good morning. I wanted to ask Paul to comment, please, on the revival of Maoism and also the HUKOU, the Hukou restrictions that seem to be really unfair and contrary to socialist doctrine.
Right. Well, the Mao revival, it may just be politics. They say that Xi Jinping is worried about the hardliners in the Communist Party, and by kind of reverting to these comments about Maoism and that he's hoping to kind of curry favor with these people and to win them over, support for himself. And so we don't really know. I mean, certainly Xi Jinping is no reformer, but I think that this his talk about Maoism is just a kind of a political show. And, the hukou issue is a really important one, because this is hukou means household registration. And so people in rural areas cannot move to the cities. Their children, they come to work, but their children, have trouble getting to schools. They're not, they don't have access to medical care. They're often, not paid by companies. And so they don't have any protection. And it's a big problem in China. And the party plenum, the third plenum, was just ended. And one of the things that they were expected to do was to do away with this system, but there's opposition among local governments, and there's fears that if they do this, there'll be a lot of farmers, fleeing to the cities, and that it will hurt kind of agricultural production. So it's still unclear whether there'll be any reform in this area. There's a lot of opposition to it.
Well, and I wonder about this news that's also coming out of that today about the abolition of the re-education camps. Now, that was first news back in January, right? And
right.
Then now it's coming out again, and it seems to have more political weight behind it. But how do you view this?
Yeah, I think there's, I agree. I think there's more political weight this time. I think they're more serious about it. But when these plenums, each time, it can take months or years before we finally find out. And they haven't given any details about how they're going to do it. They haven't given a time frame, so we don't know when. And, there's opposition from the police, because the police have power to detain somebody without going through a court, and they can hold them for a year or longer, as has happened. So the police aren't happy about this. So, and in China, it's always implementation. What people say doesn't really, what the government says doesn't mean a lot. We always have to see how they implement things. And also in the last few months, last year since Xi Jinping came in, rule of law is retreated. In the past few months, some 300 Chinese rights lawyers, activists, public intellectuals have been arrested or detained. And in many cases, their lawyers have not been allowed to even go in to see them.
And the fact that you report on that kind of thing specifically, do you think that's part of why you were denied your visa?
Yes, I do. And I should have mentioned before, but I think even I've reported on a heavy metals pollution. I've reported on the asbestos problem and things like this. And I've done a lot of reporting on Tibet and Xinjiang. And so I had to go for a visa interview at the San Francisco Chinese consulate. And when I was there, they specifically asked me about my views on Tibet, my views on the Dalai Lama, my views on rule of law, on rights lawyers, things like this. So I knew I was going to have a problem.
And then they also called in your wife, right?
This was in China every year. This was about 2 years ago when I had to renew my visa. And that was another form of intimidation. Normally journalists have to go in. The police are in charge of our visas. But my wife was a bit frightened by this experience.
And that's Paul Mooney. He is a journalist with Reuters. He's been reporting on China for nearly two decades. We're also joined by Jason Mark, who's editor of the quarterly environmental magazine Earth Island Journal. It's our Friday media roundtable on Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and let's go to Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede. Welcome to Your Call.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've been advocating the cause of global warming for many, many years. In fact, I had many debates with my friend, Professor Richard Mueller, he was in my class. I was teaching physics in Berkeley in 1966. He was very much against the whole idea of global warming, and lately he changed his mind, but I still disagree with him about the percentage of warming it has. What's happening in Philippines, what's happening in California are very related. You're going to have areas where you have superstorms and awful things, and you're going to have many areas that are going to be total drought. We also have the melting of the ice cap. We have the rising of the acidity of the sea level. What should we do about it? First of all, 40% of the carbon dioxide now is produced by China, and the United States not far behind it. So let me ask you, and ask your guest, for every gallon of gasoline you burn in your car, how many pounds of carbon dioxide do you produce? Does anybody know?
It's a great question.
Jason Mark is trying to answer.
I will tell you the answer. 19.6 pounds. So if you drive, if you fill your tank with 20 or 30 gallon of gasoline, you produce an awful lot. For every 1 gallon, 19.6 pounds of carbon dioxide, which is gas. Also,
your essential question here is, what should we do about this?
I will tell you what I recommend.
Very briefly, please.
Another thing. For every American use, would you add heating, cooling, trucking, food, farming, everything, use 20 tons of carbon dioxide a year. That is 40,000 pounds of carbon dioxide a year. 40,000 pounds. So what we need to do about it, first of all, drive as little as you can. Try not to use heating or cooling. Try to always do cooking that involve less heat. And, we have to do things individually because the media and the government
I think those are all excellent points. And there's all certainly quite a bit we can do individually. You know, in general, though, I think it's important to remember this is a political problem. I mean, our individual actions, as important as they are, that's arithmetic. And at this point, what we need is multiplication. I mean, just addition and subtraction is not enough. We need to be actually multiplying our efforts. And the way to do that is through public policies that are going to encourage less fossil fuel use. I do think you bring up a really important point that maybe, Paul, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, is with the continued morass of the international climate negotiations, there has been some rumors or maybe their wishful thinking that perhaps a China-U.S. bilateral might be the cleanest way to go, that if you can't get all of the nations of the world to agree to greenhouse gas reductions in these very difficult negotiations, what if you just had a bilateral agreement between China and the U.S.? The one, I think, downside of that is that, well, it's a little undemocratic because there's another, 180, nations on the planet. But these two countries are the lion's share, and it could work.
What do you think about that bilateral idea?
I don't know. I just don't see, China doesn't seem willing yet. They're not at that stage yet where they wanted to make serious changes. Again, they see it as kind of affecting their economic growth. And the Communist Party's policies are very short-sighted. They're just based on survival today, and they're not really concerned about what's going to happen 5 or 10 years from now. And
many political organizations are like that, right?
But meanwhile, you have lung cancer is soaring due to pollution in China.
And smoking is going down, right?
Yes, smoking is going down. But, they'd rather have kind of economic growth, and they don't realize that there's a price to be paid for this also.
And we have Steve writes to us, could the current global warming trend have anything to do with the elevated activity of the sun? It is an 11-year cycle where at this time the solar activity is at its highest. Do you know anything about this, Jason?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly the activity of the sun will affect our global weather a little bit, but the overall clear signal that is sort of disrupting the natural processes is human greenhouse gas emissions.
And let's go to Marie-Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, welcome to your call.
Hello. Pardon me, I just lost my voice.
Don't want that, yeah.
Okay, first of all, I'd like to say I am wishing that one day the Chinese people will be able to have some say over their leaders that seem to think that they are some kind of emperors or whatever still. But I also wanted to say that I think it's very important how we think and talk about these things, and much of it is very well done. But for example, when it said sensitive issues, I think we ought to say instead threatening to the administration, threatening to the leaders. And it is really a life threat to the people. And these others don't have to be living, breathing the same air that the people of China, many of them, have to do. So I'm just wondering now today with the internet, and I know much of it can't reach the people, but the rest of the world, would China in some ways listen to a lot of criticism? I'm not saying they're the only country by any means, but there seem to be huger and more severe. So I'd like to say that let's not speak of sensitive issues. Let's speak of life-threatening issues.
Thanks, Marie-Louise. Yeah, let's hear from Paul.
Well, China sees any change or some of the improvements that have to. They know that they have to improve things, but they see that as a threat to their survival. And and they've become even more sensitive than they were before about criticism, and they don't welcome it. And that's why. Journalists are having problems now. Foreign journalists are having problems getting their visas. Now we're facing more intimidation than we had before. They don't like any kind of criticism.
Well, most people don't like criticism. Jason, there was somebody who said we need to retire the term natural disaster.
Yeah, we do need to retire the term natural disaster. And I do think extreme weather is one way of kind of getting through there. Some folks even, you know, I hear increasingly some environmental campaigners use the term climate chaos. The thing to communicate is that this is not going to be a linear phenomenon. It's not as if just we're going to get warmth and drought and that is going to be the only effects. We're going to have some places that are going to have, you know, huge precipitation effects, you know, again, superstorms, storms at the strange times of years. And I think what makes it hard for people to understand is there's so many different, it is so chaotic, so it's hard to pick out what's responsible. A good example would be, say, the rash of tornadoes that we had. Now I'm forgetting if it was 2011 or 2012, but I mean, just off the charts number of tornadoes in the central part of North America. And then this year was really quiet. So that allows people to say, oh, nothing's happening. But the takeaway is that the effects aren't going to be easily predictable. And while some places are going to be bone dry, other places are going to be overly wet. And in general, I mean, the biggest impact is going to be really on our food supply.
And I was reading that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, they're extremely conservative in their terminology. So more likely than not means that there's a 50% or higher probability. I think to be likely, it's got to be 66% or higher. Is that a bit of a problem, that sort of...
I mean, the IPCC reports, it's writing by committee, and as Paul, I'm sure, appreciates as a journalist, writing by committee doesn't really work that well. And so those are consensus-based documents that are sort of taking a wide range of findings and trying to tease out, you know, a single conclusion. And they're pretty conservative. You know, you talk to, say, a Ken Caldera at Stanford, and he's going to be a lot stronger on what his models show, for example. And he's an IPCC co-author, I'm pretty sure. And yet his own research is going to come to much stronger conclusions than, say, what the consensus document is.
Let's go to another caller. Peter in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. Thanks
Hi,
for
Peter.
Taking my call. Hi, I have a question, and just a question, and I'm making a statement. And my question is, isn't this discussion about what governments could do, and I'm not specifically about China, but I use the example of Holland, which is a very strong pro sort of environmental awareness, yet Royal Dutch Shell is a mega corporation that has no interest in climate, or I don't say climate change, but taking the steps necessary to prevent that. So isn't it so that it's really industry that calls the shots? I mean, can't every government in the world say we're going to reduce emissions by a certain amount, and industry can say, no, we don't want to? And who's going to make them? And if there's any political will, as we've seen with the Tea Party and other political forces, that the advocates for industry will use whatever powers they have to crush opposition. So really, isn't it the case that industry really runs the show and will dictate, and governments are somewhat impotent in this case?
You want to take that,
Well,
Jason?
Certainly the oil and gas firms are hugely politically powerful, the ExxonMobils, the Shells, and the Chevrons of the world. At the same time, the national governments could use the power of the state to force them to ratchet down emissions. The cleanest mechanism, I think, for doing that would be a carbon tax, which actually some of the oil firms have come out in favor of because it removes some of the responsibility from them. I mean, they'll pass the costs along to consumers, and those price signals will depress will depress people's interest in continuing to guzzle gas. The real thing that we need to do is, and this is going to cost investors a lot of money, which is why it's very problematic to make it happen. But we're going to have to realize that we need to leave a lot of the oil and gas in the ground. Oil and gas that's already on the books of the oil industry, and that's going to cost them real money because that means they're going to have to strand their assets. Some of their assets are going to be stranded.
Well, I wonder about that balance between industry and government in China, where the government is more powerful, and yet they really talk about economic growth and the need for that. What's
right.
the balance
sure, you know,
there?
The government controls, it has much more control in China than governments in other countries have. And you know, and the government in China is either not taking action to deal with these issues, or they're actually supporting people who are violators. And like I said earlier, you know, we have situations where there are big companies that are polluting, And there are regulations in China, but the government doesn't enforce those regulations. So we're not seeing them. And China could do a lot more than any other country could because of the power that it has.
And do you think it's because they fear that that would squelch economic growth, or is it because of bribery or something else?
It's a combination of things. On the one hand, it's yes, they... The main thing is they're worried that that it will you know, lower economic growth, and they're worried that's the key thing. The other issue is that they don't have any control in the local areas in some ways. Mm. You know, the local environmental protection people in the villages and the cities and provinces don't come under the central government. They come under the local government, and that's who pays their salaries. And so even if the government wanted to do something, but, you know, when the government does want to do something to deal with the Internet or Falun Gong or Tibet, then they see that that what they want.
So you could see that China could make a very strong stance in this and be a leader.
Yes.
Let's go to Bruce in Monterey. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to your call.
Thank you. Yeah, one thing that's not come out in the press, and I don't see any sense of the perspective, is how limited the energy resources are in China. We buy from factories there that in the summer months they'll get where they're told that they only get power, electrical power to the factory 2 days that next week, or 3 days, or none. And so it totally shuts down their output and their production. And if they can't make it, they can't sell it. And they're strangled right now by a lack of electricity in many parts of China. So it's not a case of this monolithic government official saying, oh, let's decide where we're going to get our power, because it's very unlike the U.S., where we rarely have brownouts or blackouts. There, it's chronic. And so it's a very different situation when you're back is up against the wall. And then you also have this assumption that somehow that this government is more efficient than the U.S. government or, you know, the private enterprise, and it's not. It is in some areas. Their public transportation is a lot better than in the U.S., but in terms of energy resources, they're as inefficient as we are here in terms of how it's produced. We still produce half of our electrical power using coal. We still don't really fund, except for California, solar power, and that was actually a Republican governor that was the spearhead, Schwarzenegger, that pushed through solar, and where it's unique in California. But he got it because of Austria where and Germany, where they decided, let's fund solar instead of subsidizing coal. Because right at the time, Germany was subsidizing coal at $6 billion a year, and they said, and that was not even covering health costs for miners with black lung, but that's the cost. So that equation doesn't enter U.S. politics at all. Thank you.
Thanks, Bruce.
Yes, you know, the Chinese government's—it's quite powerful, but it's not as efficient as some people think, or we'd hope. You know, 70% of China's energy needs come from coal, and that's not going to change very quickly. Even if the government does, you know, move quickly on this, it's going to take a long time before they can reduce that reliance on coal.
And today's announcement about the reforms of the one-child policy, that was a big environmental policy and economic policy, et cetera. Supposedly, this is motivated by the fact that they're going to have a labor shortage.
Yes, it's that. And, you know, we also have there's real concern about that there were going to be a lot more men than women. In the coming years, there's already a trend where we can see because of the one-child policy, and you know, and so the government, I think, is worried about that. And it's also been a very unpopular policy, and I think that a lot of Chinese people are going to welcome this. I mean, I have friends who've had, you know, a second or third child and then had to pay almost $1,000, you know, as a fine, but they still do it. And I had we had a household helper who had three children and had them in three separate villages.
And so from the website, a listener says, why is there so little talk of population growth when we talk about global warming? Wouldn't there be less carbon usage if there were fewer people? Do you both want to just address that quickly? And then I want to try and get one more caller before the...
No, clearly, you can't have the planet and eat it, too. We need to sort of decide what we're gonna do here. And with 7 billion people on track to perhaps, you know, 9, 10 billion people by mid-century, it is totally unsustainable. We need to stabilize and then start reducing population. I do think it's unfortunate that it's fallen a little bit off the radar screen of, certainly at least here in the U.S., most of the mainstream environmental groups don't talk that much about it. We still got Paul Ehrlich down at Stanford carrying the torch around the population issue, but it needs a lot more attention.
And let's go to Raul in Novato. Hi, Raul. Welcome to your call. We're running short on time, so if you could be brief, we'd appreciate it.
Well, let me be brief then. One of the things that keeps on is a little bit of an annoyance to me in these discussions is we talk a lot about the problems, but we don't really talk about the way out. Great. The way out, as far as I see it, are solar, wind, and tidal power. And to say that we can't get there fast enough, well, how long did it take us to change from horsepower to the internal combustion engine and change this whole country and this whole planet?
Well, that's a perfect segue, Raul. Thank you for bringing that up. Let's talk just a little bit about the way out in our last couple minutes here.
Again, the technical solutions are shovel-ready and off the shelf. We know what we need to do. We need to transition. I'm glad somebody brought up Germany. I mean, Germany gets roughly as much sunlight as most parts of Alaska, and yet they've got one of the largest solar industries in the world. We should be doing the same thing in the Sun Belt, right? I mean, you know, we should be powering Las Vegas and Phoenix and Houston and all those cities off of solar. We know what we need to redesign our cities to make them less car-dependent and have more mass transit. And again, it just comes down to political will and getting our political leaders, whether in this country or in China or all over the world, to understand that we need to start getting onto really an emergency war footing. I mean, something really approaching what we did in World War II, which is saying we're gonna re-gear this economy and we're gonna re-gear it in a way that's not gonna destroy the ecosystem on which we depend.
And Paul, you get the last 30 seconds to weigh in on the way out.
Well, you know, in China, it's clear what they have to do. You know, they have to reduce the dependence on coal. They have to shift some of their industrial policies to non-less, you know, kind of energy intensive industries. And, you know, and they need to take, you know, steps to do a better job of monitoring and controlling pollution. And I hope they'll do that. But they're moving right now. I just feel they're moving slow.
And do you think with regard to your own situation and reporting on China, do you think that there's a possibility that you will have your visa renewed at some point?
No, that won't happen. China has never reversed a decision like this. And, you know, I've been quite open talking about it. Normally, people are banned for 3 to 5 years. I feel I may never be allowed to go back again.
So what's next for you?
Well, Reuters has said they'll try to find another position for me. I'll wait and see what happens.
All right, and we'll wait and see as well. That's Paul Mooney. He's an award-winning journalist with Reuters. He's reported on China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong since 1985, and last week he was denied his reporting visa for China after waiting 8 months. Jason Mark is the editor of the quarterly environmental magazine Earth Island Journal. He's co-author of Building the Green Economy, Success Stories from the Grassroots. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Holly.
And we'll put links to all of their work and the stories that we talked about at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for all of your emails and phone calls. I apologize that we couldn't get to everybody. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll bring back a conversation we had with Eugene Jarecki, filmmaker behind the documentary The House I Live In. It captures heart-wrenching stories from individuals at all levels of America's war on drugs. So far, the drug war has lasted 40 years, cost $1 trillion, and led to over 45 million arrests. But what have we accomplished? Tune in for that conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.